Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Ida History. I'm one of your hosts, Jeff Wade, sitting right across from Mr. Mark Iverson. Mark, did you enjoy your 4th of July?
I sure did. I was with you. I had some fireworks to play with, quite a few. What did we spend, like $170 from the company coffers?
I feel like I was pretty low compared to a lot of the people in my neighborhood that night.
Oh, my God. I thought some of those people were going to light their houses on fire. But we were buying stuff for your little ones, man.
That's true. So. You left around midnight. They were still popping them off to like 2 o'clock.
So. Yeah, I was like, I feel drained of all energy. So
yeah, it was quite a night.
We got our sword of greatness eventually lit on fire or whatever it was. And
yeah,
your neighbor Tom ran around with it like Arthur with Excalibur.
Not only my neighbor, but also our announcer, Mr. Tom Hart. Yeah, that's right.
He
actually barbecued for us or smoked some ribs and some chicken wings, and we had a couple drinks, and yeah, it was a good day.
It was a fun night.
It was. So speaking of having a little fun, you know what I like to do when I have a little fun, Mark, or I... Try that again.
Freebase?
Oh. Okay,
yeah.
Yeah, speaking of crimes...
Speaking of crimes, Jeff.
should we just roll with that or keep going?
Yeah, yeah, I think we should just roll with this.
All right, we're rolling with it. Yeah. So, Mark, what I was going to mention to you is a new podcast that I like to listen to. It's called Ghosts and Garnets, Murder in Idaho. And it's by a couple ladies named Whitney and Camden. Mark, you know, I think you met Whitney on one of our tours, right?
Right. She knew lots of stuff, but she also admitted that some of it was new and she really enjoyed it. And, I really like her because she, I damn near said love her because you know what? She thought I was funny. And my wife doesn't think I'm funny anymore. So when people think I'm funny, I'm silly.
You have been married a long time. Anyway, so Ghosts and Garnets, Murder in Idaho is a great podcast. Just a couple of their recent episodes. They did one on Baby X, the story out of Minidoka County.
Right.
Covering that story in our new book.
Right, Haunted Boise.
Yep. So that's a cool story, or not a cool story because the baby died, but it's an interesting story. Talking about satanic panic and all that. They also did an episode called, I haven't listened to this one. It's called Rapey Astronaut, Jeffrey Marsalis. Did you listen to that one yet?
No, that's a catchy title there.
Sure is.
Wow.
Anyway, where can people listen to Ghosts and Garnets, Murder in Idaho?
They can go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Stitcher isn't a thing anymore, from what I understand.
No, it's going away.
Right. Where else do we have our podcasts?
Apple, Spotify, the usual suspects.
Right. You can find them on your usual go-to for podcasts, and they're on Instagram and
Facebook.
And
are they on TikTok?
I'm not sure if they're on TikTok.
I don't want to sound sexist, but I feel like they're also on Pinterest.
They are. Why is that sexist? But they are probably on Pinterest. Okay. Oh, that is a thing for my wife, at least. She loves Pinterest.
A lot of ladies do, and a lot of men do, too, right?
That's where I found my, messed up photos of, botched hangings and things like that from ye olden times.
There is some, I guess Pinterest isn't just for crafts. There's some historical content on there, too, that I've come across.
Well, there's a beer company out of Boston or somewhere, and they named their bears after obscure torture and execution methods. Good beer, but there's a beer that they called Death by a Thousand Cuts.
Ooh.
I made the mistake of looking that up, and it was very popular in China up until and it's exactly what it sounds like. Okay. So what the hell am I talking about? Anyway, Pinterest.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're on Pinterest, but yeah, you should check them out. They definitely get into it.
Are we on Pinterest, Mark?
No, we're on Reddit.
We are on Reddit.
Yeah.
I have a lot of good time on Reddit. It's an interesting place. It's more of an intellectual place to go to.
I actually had a couple on the tour, my last Macabre History of Boise walking tour, and they were into our Reddit stuff. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, they were very informed.
Well, that's very nice of them.
Bless them.
Glad I'm not just screwing around on social media.
Nope.
I'm actually doing something. Mark, do we have any announcements that we want to do before we get into our episode tonight? Got our tours going, as always.
Right, we got Macabre History of Boise, Macabre History of Nampa being offered now by Jeff when he can. Yeah. And
I don't know if I'm going to do too many more this summer. It's hot.
Right, I know, man. 7:30 at night, it's still pretty hot. Yeah. But
they'll definitely be back this fall.
Oh, fall's the best. But we have our, you know, our driving tour, the Boise 70s van crime tour, you know. So look on our webpage, you know, book.
That's right. Talked about our book. It's coming out. It's called Haunted Boise, and it's coming out September 25th.
Right.
We just finished our page proofs on that, and we're waiting on like the very last round of double checking on that.
There's one more. Well, it wasn't that bad.
No, it really wasn't. We do good work, Mark. We do good work.
Yeah, I've read some of the. You know what? I'm not going to say anything negative at all. We're good writers.
We are good writers, Mark.
All right,
better than you think. Well, with that, Mark, why don't you tell us what's on the menu this week?
On the menu is prison camps in Idaho, specifically World War II POW camps for Italian POWs and German POWs. And this is weird, but some Russian POWs that were kind of incorporated, forcibly taken out of their army and made to fight for the Germans. Doesn't seem like a smart tactic, really, because how seriously are they going to fight?
Right.
Maybe a lot. I don't know.
Right.
But that's what we're talking about.
You know, Mark, this is actually an interesting topic because I've been wanting to learn more myself about it. And actually, I'm really excited about this run of episodes that we have planned right now. We've got this episode. We've got one that you don't know the topic of it, but it's going to blow your mind. And I'm excited to tell you about that one. And then I'm also interviewing an author tomorrow morning, and that's going to be another episode coming up about Minidoka, the internment camp or concentration camp, I guess is the proper term for it now.
Right.
So this kind of dovetails into that a little bit. I think you talk about the camps, the Japanese camps here a little bit. So.
A little bit, yeah. Well, I'm going to interview a vampire, Jeff.
That's a really good idea. Make sure you do that at night.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I interviewed him during the day, so I think his credibility is
shot. Was there like a gallon of sunblock laying around by chance?
No. He was just free and easy in the sun, man. Okay. I don't know.
All right, Mark, why don't we get into this? There were a number of camps and branch camps operating in Idaho for about 2 years, you know, if I remember right?
You know, right? And the main base camp in Idaho, and that's what the kind of central camps in these different regions were called, but the main base camp, which prisoners were sent to these smaller branch camps for work assignments, but its name was Camp Rupert. Not that exciting, really, but it was outside of Paul, Idaho.
Which is over eastern Pocatello, greater Pocatello area, right?
Right, yeah. Pocatello had its own camp, too. You know, like, there were many of them.
They're all over. There were more than I realized.
Right, and they would go kind of, you know, last for as long as they could, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
All right. Why don't you give us some sources before we get into this?
But of course, sir. Yeah, so I read the book American Prisoner of War Camps in Idaho and Utah by Kathy Kirkpatrick. She did a lot of research in the National Archives, and, you know, she found some pretty solid primary sources. I also relied on German and Italian Prisoners of War in Utah and Idaho, another catchy title, by Ralph A. Busco and Douglas D. Alder. And this was in the Utah Historical Quarterly. Carroll College graduate student Colin Irvin's thesis, A History of Camp Rupert, Removing the Nationality Stereotypes During World War II, it proved helpful in learning more, particularly about Idaho's camps. And finally, the most enjoyable, I'd say, read for me was Nazis on the Home Front, Boise's Valley Farmers Enlisted Prisoners of War by Susan Hook. And it was in a Boise State University publication called Other Idahoans. But the thing is, it was kind of frustrating because the thing about this essay, as with the rest of the book, is it doesn't offer source material, you know, support the claim. So I'm always a little wary. And
it's an interesting read. I've read the whole thing, I think, now, because you can read in sections, right. Certainly. There's different topics of each chapter. Definitely, I think everyone should read through it. Just, you know, like you said, not supported very well.
Well, as a work for senior honor students and graduate students, it should be footnoted and endnoted. It's just, or endnoted. It's kind of ridiculous that there's no sources listed. So I had to check anything that I really got from there. But the other thing about her title is it's misleading because most Germans that were here were not ardent Nazis. They were given quizzes and tests to see where they were kind of on the fascist scale. Yeah. And, you know, throughout America, it was kind of figured that around 10% of the POWs were ardent fascists. You know, and that's for okay. Italians, you know, for the Mussolini era.
Yeah.
And for Nazis, obviously under Hitler.
It was during this time, to be a Nazi, you pretty much had to be a member of the political party in Germany, right?
Right. Yeah. We're talking SS, like, you know, Waffen SS or whatever they're called. We're talking, you know, Gestapo people, whatever you want to call them. But we're talking, yeah, Nazi party members. And I mean, it's not that some Germans didn't believe some of what the Nazis said on some sort of scale, you know, severe to less severe. But there's a difference between a, you know, card-carrying Nazi ideologue and you know, a German soldier.
Right.
You know, though they partook in a lot of the crimes, too.
Sure.
But, you know, at least on the home front here, and they delineated between the two groups.
Interesting. So, Mark, let's talk about how prisoners of war have been treated historically. I know it has not always been that they were treated well.
Yeah, no, sir. I see a natural split between pre-Enlightenment ideals philosophized in the 18th century, you know, versus the attitudes that came before. But let's make it clear, just because the Enlightenment led to the making of a more solid international kind of rules for conducting warfare, it doesn't mean that they were followed all the time, of course, or really that much. I do have to say, though, how you treat your prisoners is as much a part of preserving democracy as the fighting of the war itself. I mean, like, look at the Soviet Union. They did more than any other nation to defeat the Axis powers, only to work POWs in their midst to death, you know, offering evidence that the world of their repressive and authoritarian government and philosophy was just, you know, it was violent, and it was counter to their claims.
Right. Yeah, the Germans and the Soviets had something in common. Minus the intentional eradication of specific groups of people, though the Soviets, you know, they've been accused of that as well later on.
Right. In medieval times, it was very much, it depended on your status in life or whether or not you lived. Archers, for example, think of the Battle of, like, Agincourt, were typically of lesser rank and thought of as less noble in a way, you know, because they fired from behind and without, you know, of the main lines. Mm. A lot of times when they were taken prisoner, they'd be executed because what are they going to offer as far as payment and stuff like that? You know, and this would go true for, you know, your regular, I guess you would say, infantryman or soldier. But so it was very much who you were if you were taken prisoner at all, really.
Yeah, nobility, lesser nobility, knights, etc., etc. They were often taken prisoner in order to be ransomed back to their families or in exchange for other prisoners. For the average class of soldiers, the foot soldiers, it very much depended on the will of the commander in question.
In ancient times, vanquished foes might be taken as slaves or put to the knife to avoid supporting them with your own resources, or as a, it could be a handy technique to inspire terror in the minds of your other enemies. The Mongols sometimes did this, as did the Huns, but so did the, you know, quote unquote, civilized Rome, as, you know, we well know. But before these groups, it was the Egyptians and the Assyrians, for example.
We're talking again about the whims of men, and after the Enlightenment in Europe, statesmen, philosophers, and other military men attempted to create laws governing warfare as, quote, war is a relation of state to state and not of man to man. Thus, individuals needed protection from execution.
One of the first major wars to address violence against combatants turned captives was the Crimean War between Russia, you know, versus Britain, the Ottoman Empire, and France from 1853 to 1856. Casualties were so horrendous and the destruction so vast, it caught the international community off guard. Treatment of the sick and wounded, including captives, demanded more hygienic and humane policies, it was argued. And this is where Florence Nightingale became so influential and famous, as she saw men dying from a lack of, you know, care, disease, and starvation.
And it was Nightingale's commitment to the betterment of health services for soldiers of every side that formed what would become the International Red Cross. In 1864, in Geneva, Switzerland, the International Red Cross Convention was held, and a treaty regarding the treatment of prisoners was drafted. This convention was revised until the Geneva Conventions of 1929 created a set of policies from which to govern imprisoning enemy combatants.
Obviously, these had not always been lived up to. During the American Civil War, for instance, it was too early for the first Geneva Convention to really have much of an impact, but the prison conditions proliferated. Andersonville in Georgia was the most notorious, where thousands of Union prisoners died of disease, starvation, and at times the sadistic treatment of their captors, and even each other, you know, fighting for food and shelter. But on entering the camp, one soldier, Robert Noble, remembered, "As we entered the place, a spectacle met our eyes that almost froze our blood with horror. Before us were forms that had once been active and erect, stalwart men. Now nothing but mere walking skeletons covered with filth and vermin. Many of our men exclaimed with earnest, 'Can this be hell?' But it was not the only such prison."
Yeah, I've read some descriptions of these prisons, and they sound much like what was going on in Germany during World War II.
Right,
some
really.
Of the camps there. Mm-hmm. An Alton State Prison in Illinois took approximately 11,764 Confederate prisoners, of which roughly 1,500 died from malnutrition and diseases like smallpox and rubella, with the most common killers being pneumonia and dysentery. These men also resembled, again, the pictures that we see of Holocaust victims basically living skeletons.
So, like, there's a war behind the war. You know, we're looking for the moral high ground in the Civil War. And, you know, in some ways, yeah, the Union had it in the big picture. But what we're talking about in imprisoning one another, I think the Civil Wars are particularly savage, as ours was. You have atrocities committed by both sides in these prisons, and some of it was you were pissed, you know, these groups were pissed at one another. Some of it was they didn't have resources, you know, or there was, like in Georgia, it was so hot, humid, and damp that there were diseases was worse there than anybody, but where it was cold, like in Illinois, you know, some of it was conditions, some of it was intentional, but it definitely was not up to the Geneva Convention standards.
Right.
But the Germans weren't much better to their POWs during World War I. They set up nearly 300 camps for Allied soldiers and would initiate punishments such as undernourishing captives, punishing them with long periods of standing, and etc. Or what a new term I saw, psychological mobbing, or rather, you know, group bullying of one or several individuals. The British and the French used German, Austrian, and Ottoman, among others, on the front lines to dig trenches, clean dugouts and trenches, and for general labor, where the chances of dying from combat wounds or disease were great. in Russia until 1917, Axis soldiers were used for labor and many thousands died. Russia was not the place to be imprisoned as a soldier, I tell you, POW.
No, I kind of wonder what's going on over there right now, honestly.
Oh,
now
that we're talking about things, it. Not good things.
Yeah. So Chapter 2 of the Hague Convention, drafted in 1899, signed in October 1907, is entirely devoted to prisoners of war. It reads, "Prisoners of war are in the power of the hostile government, but not of the individuals or corps who capture them. They must be humanely treated. All their personal belongings, except arms, horses, and military papers, remain their property." The Hague and the Geneva Conventions came to be the internationally agreed upon rules for conducting warfare, including the handling of POWs.
And it's kind of ironic that the person who instituted that was Tsar Nicholas II of Russia.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, Russia's the worst at captives other than like Z Germans. But yeah, he was also like instituted this policy, but whatever.
He was dethroned by his own people.
Right. You know, but shitheads like the Nazis don't concern themselves, obviously, with international rules or being humane in general. Stalin didn't either. Millions died in concentration labor camps and in gulags. And I'm just talking about the combatants and their prisons and not even including the German extermination camps or what the Soviets did to their own people and others later on. That's just too much for this topic. But
right, yeah. If those authoritarian countries treated their prisoners horribly, it made it a million times more important that the Allied powers treat their prisoners humanely. Democracies must be better, lest they are not democracies. They are the nations of the tyrannical.
Exactly. And so we come to World War II on the home front. After that, very quick summary of very complicated issues. But
that's a good one.
Yeah, thank you. But specifically, speaking of Idaho, you know, that's the home front we're going to talk about in our little case study here. And though there were issues with the camps at times, like when Private Clarence V. Bertucci murdered 9 and injured 19 sleeping German POWs with a 30 caliber M1917 Browning submachine gun at the Salina POW camps in Utah on July 8th, 1945, but most of the camps cared for their prisoners in the most humane fashion possible. Bertucci was deemed insane, and he was committed.
Okay.
So the policy at that camp was to take care of them, but one lone actor, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're Nazis. Hopefully. I'm just saying, you know, hopefully they weren't German, regular German soldiers or whatever.
It'll be terrible to, you know, be captured in combat, shipped halfway across the world, then just be murdered, right?
Right, and he just sprayed all the tents as they're sleeping in them. He didn't, like, you know, delineate between anybody.
He took over a tower, didn't he? Which was where the machine gun was.
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. It was, he had been out, kind of on, what do they call, not furlough, but just on the town night, I believe. And he got back and was about midnight, and he got, you know, his gun, and he was on duty, and then he just started doing that.
Jeez, okay. Scary. And there was good reason to feed them well and give them comfortable living quarters if possible. They were providing labor for the United States. In Idaho, this meant farm labor more often than not. There were two base camps, one in Rupert in eastern Idaho, and then the Farragut.
He was like a naval commander, some explorer up in Alaska, wasn't it?
I think so. Yeah, so Farragut Naval Base up north, which is where they test submarines in that deep lake there.
Right.
And then they had those two base camps were the main areas, and then groups of prisoners would move to smaller branch camps for specific contracts.
You know, in Farragut, though, it was a base camp was different because they mainly worked there, and they had over 1,000, but they basically kept the training center there in tip-top shape and also gardened, you know, but they didn't so much get... They didn't go to branch camps like at Camp Rupert, okay. Which was larger and more to that purpose. But, you know, Idaho had approximately 21 camps, though Camp Rupert, as a base camp, oversaw camps in Idaho as well as in Utah and a few in Montana. The Idaho camps varied in size of population and duration of existence. out past Nampa, where we went today, near where we now sit, sat the Upper Deer Flat Camp, which was constructed by the Upper Deer Flat Labor Association on the Schwartz Farm.
Yes, we used the Schwartz and traveled on out there this evening, and there's nothing out there anymore.
Nope. LDS church, temple, not temple, no, but
meeting house,
yeah. Meeting house, yeah.
Yeah, so they built a 220 by 330 foot double ringed barbed wire fence around the camp, which contained approximately 37 tents holding six prisoners, each for a total of around 225 POWs. There was a mess hall, a kitchen, pit latrine, and a wash house as well. The camp was built on the Schwartz Farm, south of Nampa, on which a guard tower allegedly stood until 2006, when a windstorm blew it over. Kids apparently once used it as a fort.
That would have been cool.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, most of the camps looked like that, too. You know, there's no point in describing a ton of them because they're all kind of similar.
Similar, yeah.
Right? Ad hoc things, temporary. But there's a camp in downtown Emmett, for example, and located on Main Street, as a farmer named Wayne Harper stated. But, you know, I have to mention in the same article, the author states it was where B&E Storage was. I'm not sure where that is now because I tried to look it up, but... you know, but that's at least where she said it was in 2014. But so who knows for sure? But there was a branch camp called Camp Franklin in Nampa, which held 377 prisoners at its max.
I believe that was up like on Franklin and Cherry Lane area.
Okay.
Up there. So kind of Idaho Center-ish area.
Okay.
And then there were camps in Wilder, Minidoka, Blackfoot, Rigby, Pocatello, Payette, Marcing, Jerome, Farragut, Preston, Jerome, Shelley, Sugar City, Jerome, Thomas, Fort Hall, Jerome. So wait, never mind. Sorry. Holly Lake, Idaho Falls, Filer, and Aberdeen. The Pocatello camp held nearly 1,000 men conducting agricultural labor, and at one point, as did Farragut, where POWs maintained the important Naval Training Facility and Garden, but Camp Rupert, which is close to Paul, Idaho, was the main camp, which housed nearly 4,000 Italian and German POWs at its peak, as well as, Mark mentioned earlier, some Russians, which had been forced to serve Germans.
Yeah, right, and yeah, that's kind of a weird place to be. They're like, I didn't really want to fight for them. Maybe some did, but I don't think most did.
Although it sounds like they probably had a better life coming over here.
Oh, yeah.
Than they would have faced in a German POW camp.
Right. The Italians especially said that. But across the U.S., the camps incarcerated nearly 426,000 POWs from 43 to 1946. Camp Rupert and its branch camps in Utah and Idaho imprisoned 11,660 POWs, roughly, during that same time, and mostly in helping with agricultural production. The United States possessed over 175 base camps with 550 branch camps, the majority of which were in the South and Southwest. Southern Idaho had more than North, you know, basically did, as there was more agricultural acreage to be harvested.
At all of these camps and subcamps, it was expected for U.S. personnel to practice the Articles of the 1929 Geneva Convention, which decreed that prisoners deserved hygienic living conditions, the ability to worship or practice their religion as they wish, eat as well as their captors ate, and wear as quality of clothing as did their captors. They were only permitted to work 10 hours a day. It could not work on munitions or other weapons projects.
Well, basically anything that would be thrown at their own side, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, you're just inviting them to sabotage it anyway, so...
Right, exactly. That's a good point. Yeah. They received wages, too, upwards of $2.22 a day, with 80 cents going to the prisoners themselves to be used in the canteen, which was a nice bonus, while the remaining $1.40 or so went to the government, which, you know, in most cases turned that around and used that to fund the POW incarceration facilities.
So I just want to be clear on that. That money was coming from the farmers or whoever the workers were being contracted out to, right?
Right, yeah.
Interesting. It's more than inmates make today in state prisons.
Oh, wow.
POW labor would be contracted out to farmers, in Idaho's case, at minimum wage rates if they could prove they were short labor due to the war and needed the help to bring in a crop or tend to crops in the field. They worked in beet fields and orchards and canneries and on the Farragut. It shouldn't be that hard of a word to say, Mark.
Farragut
Naval Base. And so, and you know, a full and healthy, meaning happy prisoner was better for all.
Recreational activities were also a requirement of the Geneva Conventions, and prisoners took to these activities, especially soccer, eagerly. Italian POWs set up bocce ball courts and baked bread for entertainment and just good eating, while the Germans made sand miniatures of their towns back in Germany or Austria. That seems German to me. I don't know why. Yeah, it's like we'll make a miniature camp of our, you know. Sand castles. Just feels very much like, yeah. But maybe that's just me. But okay. Both nationalities, you know, really seem to enjoy putting on plays.
I mean, what else do you have to do in your downtime, though?
Right. Yeah. Play around.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, think about, like, movies like The Great Escape and, you know, a lot of those movies kind of, you know, they always had some kind of a play or something going on, right?
Right.
Well, most of the prisoners were not zealots or fanatics. Around 10%, the majority of historians approximate, were Nazis or supporters of Italy's fascist dictator, Benito Mussolini.
El Dickface, I think they called him.
That's El Duce. There, Mark.
Yeah. Well, he's a dick face. He was, right? He got rocked. He got stoned.
He got his, yes.
Yeah, he got his. But there's a gravestone for a German POW that died in Utah and whose fellow soldiers funded and made a marker for that stands to this day at Fort Douglas Cemetery in Salt Lake City. At least, I think it was just replaced, but I'm not sure. Mm. On Paul Eilert's grave is a German star with a, not star, cross, star. That's not quite as authoritarian looking.
Yeah, like the Iron Cross that you'd see on there.
You know, injury. Lemmy from Motorhead wouldn't be quite as crazy looking and intense looking with a star. Yes. He'd be Prince.
Yep.
But in the middle of this German star was a swastika. You know, and I'm not sure if this puppy is still standing, but I went on find a grave, as I tend to do. And as of August of 2022, the latest photo, you know, that was added to the profile, you see a new white stone minus a swastika that'd be added. You just don't think that's very Utah.
I think they would have just went and chiseled that thing off and left it. But yeah,
whatever. They should have. Yeah.
So it's actually like the what we would see on a U.S. service member's grave today, like the plain white.
Okay. Yeah, just plain white.
Interesting. The power of Hitler's fascist ideology was nearly impossible to erase. On April 20th, 1944, at Camp Rupert, the Nazi contingent of 250 POWs decided to celebrate Hitler's birthday by making flags with swastikas on them and refusing to work while also being belligerent and antagonistic of guards and the non-fascist prisoners.
Yep, straight up dickery, Jeff.
Quite so, Mark, me boy.
And I quoteth, the guards placed 35 members of the Nazi group in either the guardhouse or solitary confinement. They herded the remaining 250 rebellious prisoners. Well, I just refuted my 250, but I'm using additional or various essays and whatnot. Right. So, yeah, anyway, at least your core German prisoners, not the officers, I would imagine. But anyway, they put these prisoners into an outdoor pen on the camp's confines.
The cooler?
The cooler.
The cooler.
Yeah, the cooler for the cool kids. Hmm? The camp staff issued each German a blanket for warmth and gave the prisoners bread and water instead of their normal meal. And one cold night during the strike, the prisoners set dry sagebrush and weeds on fire. When the guards sprayed water on the field to put out the fire, the prisoners got wet and became cold. Due to the discomforting cold and their hunger, the pro-Nazis called an end to their strike of 8 days. Well, that sure showed the fear of their loyalty, didn't it? Jeez. Yes.
I think you had better things to worry about at the time.
Right.
The Italians became our allies after July 24th and 25th of 1943, when old Mussolini was struck of his power and the new Prime Minister of Italy, Pietro Badoglio.
Yeah, I don't know.
Badoglio. His government joined the Allies.
Right. I guess that's when they kicked Mussolini out. And so to edit myself, I'd say I think they joined in October. They capitulated with the United States or whatever they called it and became our allies. But the Italian POWs that supported the new government and denounced the fascist movement in Italy were allowed to join the Italian service units and given uniforms to replace their prison clothes. They were the same brown khaki uniforms American servicemen wore, except with, you know, an Italian flag emblem on the side or their arm. And they were put in separate camps, or at least sections of camps, with permission to take leave, visit towns, and most importantly to them, talk to girls. They liked that a lot, apparently.
So, Mark, you know, I grew up down a mountain home, and we had the Air Force Base, and the Air Force Base trained a lot of servicemen from other countries, and they would wear their uniforms from those countries. And it's so bizarre seeing members of foreign militaries in towns like this. So
right, just walking all over the place.
Can't imagine what that was like back during the war, anyway.
Right.
But these Italian service units did the same type of work as the Civilian Conservation Corps did during the New Deal, basically helping out with the war effort. Those that joined in Idaho went to Camp Rupert and then on to elsewhere, working in armaments and in agriculture. They eventually were cleared to return to Europe and Africa to aid in the war effort.
You know, and so it's interesting you hear, like, for these guys, Italian families in the areas around the camps would, like, host them for Italian dinners and things like that. So they were definitely welcomed after they became ISU soldiers, but
yeah.
But for the most part, American civilians seem to appreciate the German and Italian POWs. Most like the most like the ISU units as allies, though many families in Idaho urged their daughters to stay away from the Italian men because they feared to lose them to, like, Italy, right?
God, the sexy Italians.
Yeah, they got the machismo, man.
Yes, they do.
They do.
All right. In fact, most of the Italian men to marry women, including some in... Is that they chose to men marry?
In fact, most of the Italian men to marry American women,
oh, okay.
including some in Idaho, came to the U.S. after being repatriated.
Got it. Okay. In fact, most of the Italian men to marry American women, including some in Idaho, actually came back to the U.S. after being repatriated in 1946-1947. American women traveled to Italy and in some cases Germany to get married and to bring their spouses home to the States.
There's a Cary Grant movie entitled I Was a Male War Bride, which was loosely based on these marriages.
I need to watch more of his films.
North by Northwest is fantastic.
Wasn't it part of that film tier in Idaho somewhere?
Oh, yeah, maybe. The farm scene or the plains? I don't know.
Yeah.
But, Hitchcock movie. One of his best.
Right, yeah. Though enemies, German and Italian POWs were largely accepted as a helpful addition to local populations, but the same was not true about the Japanese, United States civilians or not.
I quoteth, one other characteristic of the camp setting was the attitude of Americans toward the enemy troops. Several Gallup poll surveys illustrate the fact that stereotypes based on race were much stronger in America than those based on nationality. One poll from February 5th to the 10th, 1943, asked people a question about who they thought was America's chief war enemy, Japan or Germany. Of the people interviewed in the Mountain States, 55% said Japan while 34% pointed at Germany as the main enemy.
Well.
Yeah, right?
I guess we were attacked by Japan. I guess I could see that.
That's a good point. But, you know, you also had all the cartoons of Slap a Jap.
Mm. Theodore Geisel.
Oh, is that who did that?
Yeah, also known as
Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss. Yeah.
Right, that's the famous one. And you have these very dehumanizing. While the Hun, as they said in World War I or whatever, was a fierce looking, like, aggressive white dude, he wasn't stereotyped as, like, a, you know, very narrow eyed animalistic looking buck tooth person, which is the stereotype of
Japanese. So there were some efforts to escape these camps in Idaho and the United States. All of them failed. Some just wanted outside of the wire for a brief moment, then returned. Actually, Mark, remind me, I have a story to tell you about a person who escaped from a camp, and I'll tell you that here in a bit. Maybe I should tell it now since I brought it up.
Yeah, go ahead.
So we're talking about escapes from these camps. I'm not going to use any names or locations on this because I don't really have permission. So one of my friends, his uncle was delivered by a German doctor in a hospital here in the United States. That German doctor was actually an escapee from one of these camps.
Okay, well, like 99.199% didn't work out.
And I don't know if, like, if he was like just leaving the camp when he wasn't supposed to type thing, and then, you know, working as a doctor on the side type thing. I don't know the detail. I want to know the details of that story, but someday
maybe he was avoiding repatriation to some Russian controlled area.
Possibly.
I don't blame him.
Anyway, you know, some of these people just wanted outside of the wire for a brief moment and then returned. Most of the disturbances in these camps were between the prisoners themselves, which is how the Germans at Camp Rupert declared the Italians cowards and the Italians called the Germans fascist nut jobs, basically.
Yeah. The pro-fascists and those who simply saw themselves as having been soldiers for their country, or the non-nutsos, as I call them, didn't get along either. And fights happened, but most of the prisoners that served time in Idaho felt they had lived and worked in comfort, and many liked America enough to return and become citizens. Some married Americans, and some simply came.
Hold on, we got planes attacking. Nazis!
Oh my goodness, it's the Red Baron, but that was World War I, of course, but... Most of the prisoners that served time in Idaho felt they had lived and worked in comfort, and, like I said before, because I'm reading this again, liked America enough to return and become citizens. Some married Americans and some simply came back, but most noted the freedom they had to worship at how they saw fit, eat good food, stay warm, play sports, and be treated kind most of the time. This sold them on democracy.
Not to mention Europe was kind of in a mess during this time. So.
Right, but they had been used to authoritarianism for so long, and America wasn't in a mess. But many of their letters, they said why they came was because they were treated with kindness, and they hadn't experienced that for years.
That's very cool, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you say what you want about America, but sometimes it is the best country in the world.
Right. I mean, there are not many awesome countries, right? There's some awesome, I don't mean like in a beauty, but like most governments have been kind of fucked up. But that's from my reading. I focused on screwed up things in school, but but still.
So evidence of the alternative came as POWs were repatriated in 1946. At Camp Rupert, POWs would hide under barracks and do anything they could to be not sent back to Soviet-occupied territory, which was essentially the eastern half of Europe at the time, right?
Right, yeah.
While those sent back to Britain or France served an average of 4 years after the war ended to clean up the mess that they were partly responsible for, in the Soviet Union and the territories they occupied, POWs served upwards of 10 years on average and died by the hundreds of thousands, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, some of these guys... And I'm not exactly sure it was broken down, but they weren't essentially going home. They were going to places to rebuild, you know, and God, the Soviet Union, can you imagine? 2 million people were killed in Stalingrad.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, in some ways it's like, okay, I guess I would get the impulse to, you know, pay them back.
Yeah.
Because they'd literally wipe. It was a war of attrition in the Soviet Union. But... Anyway, but look at what, you know, being humane afforded the United States. You had millions of dollars in production, agricultural production, industrial production, that would not have happened without these POWs. The US of A also made less enemies out of our former enemies by acting as the counterweight to what many had suffered through in their own countries. Italian and German soldiers starved and died of disease in the millions, and entire generations of young men died. They're kind of eradicated by fighting and being forced to fight. And though the Russian people bore the brunt of the German onslaught, the Soviet regimes to follow did their people no favors in how they treated POWs.
I think it was a preview of what was to come for most Russians and Eastern Europeans, as millions would die for the, quote, betterment of the cause of the Communist Party.
The complexity of history is seen in the story of POWs in America, however. Yeah, we were more threatened by our own Japanese citizens than we were of German and Italian POWs. This is proven correct in numerous Gallup polls from the time. You know, I'm proud of the United States for how it treated its POWs, but at the same time, I feel shame when I consider how we treated Japanese Americans, you know, and those longtime residents of America who were Japanese. You know, basically, they helped to make it what it was and what it is now.
Yeah, and I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole right now because we're covering this, like I said, soon. But yeah, the Japanese people were ripped from their homes, from their businesses, were forced to sell off their property at a loss, put in these camps where they lived, they fell in love, they died. And what for? There was only one person that I've seen this figure. I don't know how true it is, but there's only one Japanese person that was convicted of any kind of like subversion during the war, and that was just because he plowed under his strawberry field because he didn't want to sell it off at a loss.
Right. So, I also read that the Japanese Imperial Japan they weren't dumb enough to use Japanese people or Japanese Americans to spy in America. You know, they used white people.
Yeah.
There were Germans.
Yeah.
You know, but upwards of 120,000 American citizens and longtime Japanese American residents were from the coastal areas were imprisoned. Yeah. And like you said, I know in Seattle there are people who ask friends to look after their stuff, and they ended up swindling them oftentimes too.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, those are good thoughts. You know, but from what I read there's not much craziness or, interesting tidbits to add to this episode, you know. The farmers were like, well, they worked real good. They, you know, they helped us out.
Talked a little funny, though.
Right, yeah. Yeah, some of them. Well, you know, I mean, with education, they had educational programs where they had to try and find German books on written books on American history or find translators or something.
Yeah.
You know, but that was the most popular of all the classes was American history and the English language courses. So, see, some of them were like, I think I want to come to America later. You could see it ahead of time. But, you know, these POWs came from the North African theater, the Italian front, the Western front, and the Eastern front. And for the majority, it was an improved life in America behind the wire than it was a quote-unquote free soldier. But in Idaho and Utah, the majority of POWs farmed. They farmed potatoes, beets, grain, fruits, and orchards, and etc. Though that's hard work, it beats getting shot at and not eating and, you know, dying in pain.
Yes.
And etc. Being cold all the time, not having food, blah, blah, blah.
Right, yeah. Well, most of the camps left little to prove that they actually existed. The hundreds of barrack buildings that once stood in a farm field outside of Paul, Idaho, have vanished. Camp Rupert was torn down to be repurposed in 1947. It had a large hospital, mess halls, recreation facilities, washrooms, latrines, ball fields, kitchens, everything you need basically to hold people.
Well, and imagine most of those held 50, the barracks held 50 guys, and they had 4,000.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot of...
right.
And that also holds true of the branch camps as well, like we found today when we visited the upper Deer Flat camp, right?
Right.
You never would have known. It just looks like farmland.
But during the entire shitstorm that was World War II, America and its allies treated its prisoners the best. All except for the Soviet Union, that is. Hundreds of thousands of Japanese prisoners went to Russia and elsewhere. The Soviets controlled you know, these other areas that they'd go to, and many thousands died on major infrastructure projects working in them in the gulags and whatnot. But the Japanese soldiers that were caught by America, Britain, and the Australians, among others, but they lived in camps in Australia, and some, not that many, came to the U.S. Mainly for interrogation. I heard some of those went against the Geneva Conventions, but anyway, but most of all, they were, for the most part, they were treated well. You know, they did face racial slurs and bigotry the Germans and Italians didn't really have to deal with.
Only about 35,000 to 40,000 Japanese soldiers were taken prisoner, really, and they didn't, you know, they didn't tend to surrender.
And that's the Americans, right?
Right, yeah.
Because the Russians in China, you know, parts of Japan, well, not parts, in China, yeah, there were prisoners taken there from what I understand, but that's an area I don't know much about.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think the best way to combat authoritarianism and fundamentalism is through remaining humane in the face of great violence, hatred, and anger, you know. What do you say, Jeff?
Well, that's something that we found out back in our Aryan Nations episode, right? The, you know, Bill Wasmuth and the Kootenai County Task Force, they basically fought hatred with peace, right? They didn't fight back. They showed, you know, the right way to do things, and definitely respect that.
Right. I mean, look at after World War II, you had the Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
To help Germany rebuild.
Rebuild,
and then,
yeah.
I forget what it was called in Japan, but they had a similar plan that helped Japan rebuild as well. And yeah, we, you know, there's a lot of controversy about dropping the bomb and all that, and then firebombing in Germany, but you know, we also have some moments, and that was in for great atrocities, obviously, on other sides. And you want to talk about horror to their prisoners, Japan, Germany obviously gets focused on more, but
right.
For reasons, but extermination. But Japan did that too.
I know what was going on in China was just absolutely horrific during World War II at the hands of the Japanese.
Medical experimentation, mass.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I understand the need, I guess, to get retribution. But at the same time, if you're not, the Allies didn't get the same treatment as the Chinese, right?
Yeah.
Though it was harsh and bad, but I think it's important to show the world that in a democracy you have to be better.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really have much thoughts to add to that. I mean, it's pretty, I guess, admirable that the United States actually, I mean, and again, these people weren't living the best life compared to what we are today, sitting here in our nice comfy office studio and talking about this stuff. But I mean, during the time period, they lived pretty good compared to a lot of the other people around the world.
I mean, that's, people want to talk about American exceptionalism, and I believe there are certainly moments where America has been rather exceptional.
Yeah.
And America, like we were saying, is much better than repressive Soviet Russia.
Yeah.
And damn better than fascist Germany. And I think the proof is definitely in what we and how we treated the POWs.
So one thing that I read that I wanted to ask you about, I think it was in the other Idahoans, Nazis on the Home Front section. I think if I remember right, the author of that talked at the end about how, so the labor of these POWs was needed because of the war effort going on. A lot of the able-bodied men were being shipped off the Pacific into Europe to fight the war. So that kind of left a vacuum that needed to be filled with these POWs.
Right.
But then after the POWs left, which, like you said, they only were here for about two growing seasons or so.
Well, some of them stayed longer after the war ended, and they didn't like that. In fact, they were treated poorer after the war ended. Mm-hmm. Which we could go
interesting,
into.
Yeah. But I think, if I remember right, doesn't she make the point in that once the POWs left, that kind of open the way for the migrant workers to come in there on their heels. Right.
Yeah, there was the Brasario program. That was in, what, the late 40s, 50s? Or was that before? I don't remember.
I can't remember.
Yeah. But, yeah, there were programs that, like, migrant labor was needed.
Yeah.
Right. So that's also connected to issues of today. Like, yeah, it was brought in because it was important.
It was needed, right?
It was needed. And, I mean, they needed cheap labor, and migrants needed the job and were willing to work for. And that is the story of America.
And
right?
Nothing's changed.
Right. Chinese come over here, you know, in the 1860s, 70s, or what? They, without them, American development of what would become the West and our whole industry across the nation would not have been the same. Yeah. And then Japanese regionally after that, the Oregon Short Line and other things.
Well, when during the period of the Chinese Exclusion Act,
right,
Chinese weren't allowed into the United States. We still needed that labor, so the Japanese filled that need.
Well, and largely, you know, the Irish definitely played their part for sure, but, you know, they were a troubled group, a impoverished group, you know, because of what was happening in England to them or in Britain. But, you know, you get this thing where you get impoverished groups will work really hard because they don't have a choice. You know, and you know, obviously the freedmen from the South, they came and they worked hard, and it's just, that's the story of America, man, in many ways.
Yeah.
You get these POWs who are working hard, you know, and they're like, it's beats the alternative.
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, and then each group becomes part of America, and yeah, they got to fight for those rights sometimes, but yeah, they, wow. I think an overcoming discrimination and oftentimes violence, enough of America, I think, has the freedom to come around in thinking, you know, and we're always doing it. You always have to work to be better in a democracy, but you have the freedom to do so.
It's true.
Without, you know, being repressed, right? Yeah. Whatever you feel about presidents and all that, you and the different parties, you can stand out there with a sign for the most part and be like, fuck this.
Yeah.
And not get shot. Yeah. For the most part.
Yeah, I mean,
it, you know,
might get shot by someone
like Kent State and
maybe
stuff
not the
like
government
that, but,
well, yeah,
right, but yeah. You know what I mean, you know. Yeah, what I'm definitely trying to say, like,
yeah, I mean, we talked about the anti-war movement in Vietnam, and you know, that was people expressing their distaste or dislike of the war. And they had some difficulties, but ultimately they had the right to stand up and say no to that war.
Right.
Which I, in Germany during World War II, you would have been shot if you would have done that, right?
Yeah.
It's probably the same in Japan and other countries.
I was watching this Frontline on PBS today about Iran, and women just want to have their hair out and be able to express themselves, and they're getting shot. You know, I mean, and it was some just crazy number of people that are protesters being killed in Iran, and they want their freedom. Not a lot, not the majority of the people there support the Ayatollah, but they can't go out without being shot at. Imagine if that was happening here.
Right.
You don't have America if you don't have protest and counter protest abilities.
It's true.
So even though I don't agree with, you know, one side or the other, I agree with their right to be out there doing that.
Definitely.
Right. But anyway.
All right. Let's wrap this up,
well,
shall we?
We treated him well.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
I guess we can be proud of that.
Right.
Let's go and wrap this one up, Mark. We're going to come back next week with a subject that Mark doesn't know about yet, but it's going to dovetail in with this topic so much.
Right.
And then
it's cool.
Also going to dovetail with our next episode after that, which is going to be about... I have a interview with Maggie Takota Hall. Forgive me if I'm saying that wrong. But she's the descendant of a couple who met and fell in love and married in the Minidoka concentration camp.
Cool.
She wrote a book about it. It's called Love in the Library. We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about her grandparents. And then she actually visited Minidoka this past week. So we're going to be able to talk to her about that. And I'm really looking forward to that interview. So
we got to go out there sometime.
We do. All right. All right, let's
buddy.
Go and say goodnight and see you next week.
Sayonara. Auf Wiedersehen.
Ciao.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.